Hi, this is Doug Lin, and you're joining me for another episode of Insider Stories, which is brought to you by Quiet Speculation. If you're interested in trading, or you just want to play more Magic cards and pay less for it, give the site a check out. It's the home base for all the discussions in Magic Finance, and there you'll find the greatest minds in buying, selling, and trading right now. And we are blessed to have one of those minds in the studio. Today we have Sigmund Ausfresser in the studio.
Hello, great to be here.
Now, Sig has been writing for Quiet Speculation for 3 years now, and Sig is also a very active trader. And if you are on Twitter and you are following Magic Finance at all, you got to be following him. He moves markets. He engages in daily discussions. You are great to talk to and watch the conversations. I'm just looking forward to interviewing today and finding out about your history in Magic Finance. So, Sig, how long have you been playing Magic?
Wow, I've been playing Magic since roughly around when Vision / 5th edition was new.
So that's when Magic was still kind of in its slow period, right?
Yeah, and I like to joke that I started playing Magic back when you didn't know what card was the rare in the pack. And I'll never forget, you know, that naive me, the first time I saw a Phyrexian Walker in a pack, and I thought, oh, it's a zero mana creature that can attack, because I was used to paying green for Wall of Wood. And so I thought, this is the best card I've got, and I was excited to play it, only to find out it's, you know, worthless common.
Well, and then, I mean, Ornithopter was a perennial favorite, and I certainly had the Ornithopter deck where you put the Unstable Mutation on it, and it's like, yeah, I got a 3/5 on the first turn, that kind of stuff, so I don't blame you. Yeah, I remember that era. I think Exodus was the first set that had the rarity symbol on it,
yes.
And a whole lot of sharky traders cried because now you couldn't rip off a little kid who didn't know what the set symbol was, so I think it was also a controversial thing at the time to be adding a rarity symbol, which is, you know, try and find Magic without controversy. So you started in around Visions. Did you have a favorite card around that time?
Well, I remember avidly trading for Craw Worms at about a dollar in trade, and Scaled Worm was a little bit more valuable than that.
Now, for listeners, Scaled Worm is 7 colorless and 1 green, and it is a 7/6 vanilla creature, which was huge at the time.
Yes, yep. And then forget, you know, things like Force of Nature, Colossus of Sardia, you know, they had the whole 8/8 trample, 9/9 trample, 10/10, 11/11, and 12/12. They were all way out of reach for us. You know, if you didn't open it in a pack, you couldn't afford those cards.
Absolutely. So when did you find out that Magic cards were worth money? Were you reading Scry or something?
I was a big Inquest fan. Mm-hmm. I still collect the Inquest magazine. So if anybody, any listeners out there have worthless Inquest magazines they want to get rid of, I will give you at least some money for it rather than letting them collect dust in your basement.
You know, I had looked and you can buy a complete set or a nearly complete set of Inquest for maybe like $150 on eBay.
They sell the complete sets on there?
Yeah, you can get large print runs of Inquest for a very low price. And I was thinking, entrepreneurially, I don't know who owns the rights to that magazine, and the copyrights in it are probably impossible to get permission for all the Monty Python pictures in it, but somebody would pay something for Inquest magazine in PDF form. Wouldn't that be great? You know, you sit down with a tablet, you have like 200 issues you get to read through, you get to see the ads, the price lists, you get to see them call Necropotence a 1-star card and the worst card in Ice Age. Like, that would be great. There's a market for that. If you're listening and you know how to secure those kinds of copyrights, talk to me. And I will enthusiastically read. So
the only thing that you miss out on, though, is you won't get your free 50 hours of AOL on floppy disk.
No, that will not be in there. So were you actively trading when you started, or when do you think you started taking trading seriously?
Oh, gosh. That must have come a lot later. I mean, and to be fair, and I think this is the same story for a lot of people, I was in and out of the game nonstop, so there was never really a long stretch where I went really deep into the game. So, of course, when I was young, we traded for fun. Sure, I need that card for my deck. Whoa, Unholy Strength and Holy Strength on the same creature? I have to trade for that.
I love it.
So things like that, you know, we would often pursue, but I didn't really seriously trade for much longer after that. It was around Time Spiral Block was that actually naturally that set, having all the old school cards in there, got me back into Magic after I had been away for a while, and so that's when I started getting a little into more of the competitiveness of it, and then naturally the trading that goes along with it.
So when you were getting back into the competitive trading and stuff, were you hopping on the internet to look at cards and?
No, I mean, I was not very naive at first, and I was, you know, just trusting what, you know, people's valuations were. This was before everyone had smartphones and all that, and so I knew, like, what my favorite cards were worth, but there were so many cards I didn't even know existed that I would see in a binder and think, I want to have that, and so I was just at the mercy of the, you know, the sharks, if you will. So I definitely probably, I'm assuming that I made some rough trades early on, but it was still later than that even that I realized that there was this whole value trading and all that. And I hate to give any positive credit to this guy, but I mean, Medina was really the one who got me into that. So you know, we went to the same local card shop, and so I noticed that he had a binder just full of every valuable card. You know, he had edit in standard, he'd have multiples of all the $20+ cards, and I was just baffled by that. And I remember distinctively asking him one day, you know, like, how do you have all these cards? Do you open all those packs? Because that's how I used to get my cards, is opening packs. And he told me, no, I just trade. And so I, you know, I started observing, and then I got into Twitter and started following him and, you know, reading all his Pact of Power, his articles. That's really what was the light switch for me.
And I think that, you know, that was a style of trading that I think is kind of disfavored in Magic Finance right now. I think at that point it was attempting to exploit an information gap, and, you know, say, what do you value this at? And you take the person at their word instead of...
Yeah. And I learned that that was kind of the style, and that really did not mesh well with me.
And luckily, I think smartphones have really put a halt on that, because if somebody says, you know, let me look up what this card costs, I'm going to look up Sarkhan here, and they're like, wait, it's $18 and you want to give me $5 for it? You know, that it's harder if you want to be a shark to prey on those kinds of people. And I think that's good for the game that people aren't being taken advantage of, because it sucks. It sucks when, like, you find out, oh, that guy at the shop was really excited about my Jace the Mind Sculptor, and he gave me 4 dragons for it. Like, like, that sucks when you're later on and you realize, like no, that dude just ripped me off.
Yeah, I remember the last trade I made where I got ripped off. It was a very small one, and where I knowingly got ripped off. And, mm-hmm. you know, there was a new angel out. I collect all the angels, and so I wanted to trade for it, and it was just a bulk angel. I think it was like the new Phyrexia one. What is that? Chancellor of the something, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the name of it, but it's worthless. And so I saw it, and I thought, I've got to have that angel. You know, what's it worth? And they said, oh, it's worth $5. I said, okay, fine. So I gave him $5 worth of cards. I look it up online, it's retailing for 99 cents. And I thought, this is never going to happen again. I'm just going to look up every card from now on, because you can't be expected to know the value of everything, and the phones are just so convenient. Mm-hmm. And so when people want to trade with me and they want to look up cards, I encourage it. And I'm all for making the TCG mids line up within 10 cents of each other. That's fine by me.
So if you're aiming to make a profit in Magic Finance, but you're saying, I'm going to give just as much as I get on present value, how do you even make any... How do you get ahead?
You just got to think to the future. You just got to look at trends, and that's essentially what I try to write about every week. And I'm not going to try to trade my $10 card for your $20 card. I'm going to trade my $10 card that is really hyped right now, or that's in a really popular standard deck, but standard rotates in 6 months, or what have you. Or, you know, just trade it into older cards that are going to have, you know, more secure value, aren't going to fluctuate as much. That's the ideal, I think.
Now, in addition to Magic, I know that you're very active on watching the stock market, and I love following your tweets for when you tweeted Jim Cramer and things like that.
Yes, got a retweet from him.
Nice.
He retweeted my tweet.
Twitter celebrity. How does what you're talking about in Magic, about predicting the future, how does that line up with how you approach the stock market, and are there lessons to be learned?
Absolutely. And I try to write about this. It's a little hard to come up with a significant, you know, deep insight on the spot, but one idea that comes to mind is just the concept of cycles. Essentially, you have, you know, stocks that go through cycles of being hot and then being cold. And you may think, well, how does that even work? Can't people anticipate that? But essentially, they're just talking about it now. I mean, if you think of companies that sell really expensive items that other people or companies don't need very often, like cars, airplanes, those are very cyclical. So a company, you know, airlines don't need to buy new planes every year, and it just so happens that they all tend to kind of buy planes around a similar time. For example, when oil is really low and they start to make more money, that's when they might be inclined to buy more planes, which is why I love Boeing stock right now. That's a freebie.
That's a tip right there you can take to the bank. So it's sort of the same sort of thing in magic, how you have, there's a cycle of standards.
Standard.
I know that modern, when it was a PTQ season, when it was the same thing.
Yep.
Where that after modern, you'd be able to get a 30% discount on modern cards because people didn't want them anymore. They were preparing for standard.
Absolutely. And you can always anticipate that modern staples would be a little bit more in demand, but things have shifted now that we've got PTQQs or what have you. But I still think that there's something to a cycle on legacy cards, and maybe on card values in general as a whole. I tend to see the prices drop off, like in the fall, kind of, you know, we're kind of at the tail end of that now. And then it seems like in the spring, at least in the last couple of years, thinking dual land specifically, I see them jumping. And a lot of, you know, I think this past time it was triggered by Star City Games deciding, oh, now everything's going to be 50% more expensive for duels or whatever it was. But I think that there's something to that. And I don't know what it is, if it's people getting tax refunds or who knows, but I see a cycle there, and that's something that I've been paying attention to.
You know, and the summer doldrums are a thing that hits every year for people, and it's attributed to people, and I don't quite understand why it happens. I know that it happens. It's kind of counterintuitive to me, the idea that during the summer people have more things they're doing, or they change their routines, or the college kids go back home and they're not playing Magic. But, I mean, on the other hand, you have teenagers who have jobs now, and they're getting paychecks. And I remember when I was 16, and I got a check for $150, and it's like, I don't have a girlfriend, I don't have a car, you know, I don't have, I can't go out and drink, and all my hobbies cost $20 or less to engage in, so I'm just going to go nuts with my money. So I would think that that would be a factor in Magic, but it apparently is not. I think that the fall and spring are when you see big hits on that.
Two things. First, I wish that I was a little bit more happy with my money, because I didn't have a girlfriend or a car, and my mindset was, I better save money for a car, and I probably won't get a girlfriend so easy without a car, or something, you know, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was a big saver. But then, more seriously, I don't, like, new blocks in Standard, don't they always start in the fall?
Yes.
And so you got, like, fall, you know, winter, and then spring. And then in the summer, there's really no, you know, it's like Corset or
Year we had Conspiracy, and I think people were really jazzed for that. And then they drafted it twice, and they didn't want to do it again.
Yeah, I still have yet to draft it. But the good news is, now that boxes are like $80, it doesn't look like I'm going to miss my opportunity. But so I wonder if that's related to it, just how the schedule of Wizards is. Don't they usually have softer sales in the summer and all that?
And I think that's through learning through hard experience. They either have hard-coded bad sale, like bad products in, or like this summer was always the core set.
Yeah. So. They need another unset, and that would be a big hit.
Another unset, I think.
You need to complete the block.
I think that was Conspiracy. I think Conspiracy was the unset.
You can't draft unglued, unhinged Conspiracy. That doesn't work.
So you are ambitious on stockpiling unglued and unhinged packs for that eventual draft?
I did. Unfortunately, I didn't go nearly as deep, but I did make some money on unhinged boxes. I remember, watching Unglued. I never really bought Unglued. I heard it was a thing. I was still in school then, so I didn't have a car. I couldn't go and buy packs so readily. I don't even think our local store had Unglued packs, so I never got them. So when Unhinged came out, I made sure to enjoy a couple of drafts, and then I bought a couple of boxes to sit on, which, of course, paid off really nicely.
And that's because of the full art basic lands made it at least $1 a pack.
Yeah. I mean, now those basic lands are a few bucks, and you have a good shot at getting a foil, you know, and some of the random foils in that set are worth money. Of course, everyone knows about Foil Little Girl, but I mean, I opened a Foil Save Life not too long ago, maybe a year ago or whatever. It's just a junk common. It's not one with any value, but the artwork is cool, and I had it in my trade binder, and this one kid just had to have it. So I think, you know, he gave me like $6 in value. I didn't want to let it go. I told you, like, you can probably buy one cheaper online. He said, no, I want that one now. So, you know, that was a rare instance where I did take a little value on a trade, but
I recall I harbor a little bit of bitterness with Unglued. And the reason why is that was at the same time as Urza's Legacy. And, of course, I bought a whole bunch of Unglued, and I didn't buy a whole lot of Urza's Legacy at all. And it's like, man, I could have gotten so many more awesome cards if I had just bought Legacy and Destiny instead of buying these joke cards. And I think that I think part of the issue of that was, like, there was no spoiler at that time where you could read over it and get all the jokes. Whereas if you released an unset today with Gatherer, like, I think when Unhinged came out, Gatherer didn't even exist, and I may be wrong on this, but, like, many of the jokes were still fresh.
They were all surprises. It's like, you would do a draft and think, oh, that's hilarious, I can't wait to play that.
But now it's like buying a comedy album. Like, why would you ever buy a comedy CD now when I can listen to it once on Spotify and then I'll never need to listen to it again?
Yep.
Or I can pull it up in a year. You know, like, the joke's already spent before I've even put money out.
It makes me sad that you can know what every card is in a set before you even show up at your pre-release. Not only that, you can pre-order everything, so there's not even any real chase card that you need to trade for to have for your deck. You just buy them all. Yep.
So the market has certainly changed in that regard. I mean, I know we talked about smartphones. Do you use TCG Player or eBay to sell your cards, or do you use buy lists, or how do you get rid of cards?
Usually eBay and buy lists are, you know, prime options. I've sold some on Facebook groups. They've been kind of hit or miss. I used to be a lot more active on Modal, but that's really just become a bunch of people looking for deals.
And that's the Magic Online Trading League, and I think you find it at magicleague.com. If you type in
MagicTraders.com.
MagicTraders.com. Yeah, if you type in MOTL on Google, you'll be able to find it.
Yeah.
It's a forum where people post buy lists and stuff that they want to sell, and they try and make deals happen. I'm surprised that there's... I know that Puka Trade is a way to kind of mechanize the, I want to trade this at this price, I want to sell this at that price. But there's no better matchmaking right now that involves actual dollars. Do you use Puka Trade at all, by the way?
I don't. You know, I've heard about it. I'm intrigued. I'm a little skeptical. Call me old-fashioned, but I don't like having Puka points or whatever, because one day their site can just shut down, and then you're stuck with a bunch of points, and you didn't... I don't know. That's just my big fear, my paranoia.
I tried it a little bit last year, and I think it is good for getting rid... I mean, you have to basically be on it every hour to try and matchmake, because you have to be on it to accept cards that people want.
And if you don't respond quickly enough, then they just get
somebody
else.
Yeah, it gets fulfilled somewhere else. But people have good success getting rid of, like, commander cards. Like, Scarecrow is $9. Black Market is $12. You know, these are cards that I'm not going to buy list at any profit, but somebody's willing to trade something, and then I can actually get standard cards out of it, or staples. But I haven't used it extensively. I know that it's probably quadrupled in its momentum since I last tried it, so I should probably look at it again.
Yeah, I probably should at least give it a try, and maybe start with some small things, get rid of my standard cards or whatever. I'm not a big fan of a lot of standard cards right now, so clean it up.
So let's talk about that. We were chatting before we started casting. Cons of Tarkir more than any other set recently. Cons has, like, it's tremendously popular, it's tremendously powerful, and it's so darn cheap right now.
It is, yes.
Let's talk about that. How do you feel about Cons being as cheap as it is?
Well, that certainly doesn't give me a lot to get excited about. you know, I used to watch Standard unfold when a new block would be released and it would rotate, and naturally there would be cards that maybe couldn't quite get there in the previous Standard and now all of a sudden break out in the new Standard.
Elspeth Sun's Champion is a great example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people were on that boat or train or whatever mode of transportation you want to use, and they really got ambitious, and so they bought up a bunch. I know Bekvar was big on Elspeth. And I don't know how it's done price-wise. I have never touched a copy. I mean, that was one it was kind of expensive for me to buy into. I'm sure it made people a lot of money, but I just missed that one. But yeah, it just seems like in Standard, you know, the general trend for most of the cards have been downward. Even the really strong performers, I think Fetchlands seem to be finally finding a bottom. I've been watching their chart on mtgstocks.com. And so, you know, I picked up a set of Deltas for my Legacy deck, but I finally picked up a set of Heaths and a set of, actually I just picked up more Deltas. Now that I think about it, I think it was, what's the new writer's name? Derek. Key was talking about, Polluted Delta being actually the least popular of the fetches in Cons right now because, it just doesn't have a home in Standard or Modern. I think this is, you know, that's the fetch land that you want. I think if you open up a pack of Cons and you pick up a Floodestrand and you don't need another Floodestrand, that one is, I think, the most expensive. Trade that into Polluted Delta and something else, because one thing that I do believe in very avidly is in the long term, grand scheme of magic, blue-black is the best two-color combination. And I believe that's why Underground Sea, you know, while giving a run for its money with Volcanic Island, Underground Sea has been the most expensive. And so I don't see Polluted Delta, I don't see Modern not having a dominant blue-black strategy forever.
That's an interesting point of view. You know, you and I are in an ecosystem of competitive play because we follow Standard. You and I play Modern when we can.
I try to.
I have to remember that you and I are a tiny part of a Magic ecosystem, and you brought up blue-black, and I was thinking, there's nothing in Modern. There's nothing really in Standard. There's control nothing. Decks that pop up now and then.
And fairies, but they're not a series.
But you look at a card like Glimpse the Unthinkable, Glimpse the Unplayable, you know, am I right?
Super
and
casual.
And you look at a card like that, and it's blue-black, and people go nuts for those kinds of strategies.
Yes.
And I remember I had Kyle Lopez on, and he was like, yeah, you would not believe the amount of cards we saw that are just clearly casual people building casual decks. And for me, it was a realization that casual doesn't equal cheap. People will want to buy Underground Seas for their deck that plays the new Dimir Guildmage, Duskmantle Guildmage, or whatever his name is. Like, I'm going to try and combo you out with that Guildmage and Mindcrank, and I'm going to put Underground Seas in it because I want this deck to be good and I want to I have the money to pay for it. You know, there are people like that. It's not like, well, I'm going to play Darkslick Shores because it's a dumb, crappy, casual deck anyway. Like, people have pride in what they play and they want to make it better.
They do.
I mean, Doubling Season was a $40 card for a while, not because people, it was that because people were willing to pay for that effect in an obviously casual deck. Doubling Season was never a competitive, playable card.
Absolutely not, yeah.
But still it had a tremendous price tag because there were the casual players who were like, I want to get another token with my Thalid, and then I want to make two Saprolings.
But even now, I think Jason wrote this article, like, casual stuff is not the go-to place to store money these days. You can't just buy the Glimpse of the Unthinkables because inevitably Wizards is just going to print some casual commander deck or whatever that's going to have all these random reprints. So that's the other concern. I mean, there's so many bearish characteristics right now in this market. There's downward pressure from the Wizards' new dedication to reprinting expensive cards. I don't care what Mark or Aaron will say, Mark Rosewater or Aaron Forsythe will say about Thoughtseize, why that was in Theros. I believe it was because they wanted to make that a cheaper card. They say it was because, well, we have all these indestructible gods, we're afraid that they're not, they're going to be too powerful. Yeah, sure, I guess, that's fine. But, I just think that there's a lot of reprint risk right now, and Modern Masters 2 is almost a guarantee. I actually got chastised on Twitter because I didn't say it was a guarantee. I used some sort of qualifier. I still think that there's a 1 in a million chance it could be something better. I don't know. They're going to troll us and make, like, the third unhinged block, unset, and that'll be what Las Vegas is for next year.
It'll be a misery in Las Vegas. I hear what you mean. I mean, it's no longer the case of being able to, for example, pick something up and sit on it. I think there is a safe zone, and it's really hard to make any money on this, but there is a safe zone when a card is so expensive that it would have a distortive effect on a sealed product. So let me give you an example. Is Crucible of Worlds is, I think, $25 at least right now. And they're not going to put Crucible of Worlds in one of, like, the new red commander deck, because then people are going to be like, this one card pays for the value of it, and I'm just going to buy all of them, and we're going to strand the other ones on the shelves. Now, you could put Crucible in Modern Masters too, but there are some of those cards that are safely expensive enough that you're not going to see. But then, where's the profit to be made in spending $25 on one Crucible hoping it hits 40?
Or it can show up in a From the Vaults, you name the adjective.
You can be ruined so many ways on that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, speculators, I think people are like, oh, those are the guys who want to run a Thundermaw Hellkite up to $50 and make people pay $200 to play a standard deck. And it's like, I don't know that I encounter people like that that actually actively speculate. It's like, I want to buy this card at a dollar and hope it hits three and move things in volume, because that's a much more exciting thing to stick $20 in than in buying one Thundermaw Hellkite and hoping it hits 50.
Yeah, or you could do both. I always am a fan of diversifying. I'm kicking myself right now. I don't know if people remember on Twitter, I tweeted about buying like 20 white border chokes. And I bought them, this was months ago now, and people were criticizing me, why did you buy the white border one? That's a terrible spec. And my counter was, well, I bought them at 70 cents or whatever, and Card Kingdom was paying a dollar at the time. And in fact, that 2 weekends later, I was at the GP Cincinnati, and I sold them to a dealer for a buck each. Well, now who's laughing, but...
I mean, certainly there's a feeling of regret there, but... I mean, you can't let those things affect you, can you?
No, I never regret making money on Magic. And people often, you know, will criticize me and say, you know, Simon, why are you selling out of this card? It's still gonna run, you know, or whatever it is. And I think that's fine if you want to be, you know, trying to sell closer to the peak. But we're trading in pieces of cardboard here. There's no asset back behind this. There's no gold backing these assets. There's no, like in the stock market, at least when I own a share, I am technically owning a portion of the profits that the company is making. There is none of that with Magic. And Wizards one day can just decide this is, you know, they're going to get rid of the reserve list. Or Hasbro can decide Wizards isn't making enough money. We're going to sell it and then it'll get ruined, you know? So there's just so much, like, why bother sit on excessive risk? If you're profitable on a card and, you know, and within a reasonable amount, why not just take it and move on to the next? Because there's always, you know, another card to buy somewhere.
You know, and then there are the people, like, they're the buy and holds. And, like, hold it until, like, you feel like you psychically believe it's going to be the most expensive. Like, if you got a Voice of Resurgence and Dragon's Maze in your pre-release pack, and it was $20, and then it hits $25, and you're like, I'm going to hold this. It hits $35, and you're like, I'm going to hold it. I'm looking for $60 on this.
Yeah.
And it never does, and then it drops down, and it drops down, and now they're $19.
And it's a lot harder to sell while it's dropping down than it is while it's going up.
Yeah. You know, and you were talking about, like, what's backing Magic cards, and I'm thinking, like, there's so many ways that Magic can be ruined. They can, you know, they can torpedo the reserved list. They can carve off Magic, maybe because it's profitable and they need money for their failing companies. You know, they can get an activist investor who's like, why aren't you printing all these box sets every year?
Right.
Like, Decipher did this and made a whole lot of money by making Luke Skywalker a $2 card, and they made all these box sets. Like, you're not maximizing this value. You're banking on the fact that both Wizards makes good sets and does not make bad decisions and bad sets.
Yeah, if you think about it, if Wizards wanted to, like, double the revenue that they're generating, they could print dual lands in some sort of special box set, charge, like, you know, you can do it a different number of ways, can make them foil and charge a lot for them. You can print them, like, in their old school form and put them in the new set or whatever it may be, and just sell like crazy. I mean, look at all, you mentioned cons and fetches and how well that's selling. Think about if they put $100 bills in standard packs, they wouldn't stay $100 for long, but still.
And I think that one of the themes that comes up on the show again and again is people talking about being disciplined when they're trading and selling. And, you know, it's like you can't have regret when you look back and think what could have been. Because, like, we over assign regret to things like that where you think I missed out on something, but we don't adequately assign gratitude with the thought of, oh my god, I got out of that at the right time. Like, I sold my Liliana of the Veils right before they dropped $20. Like, we don't figure that stuff out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I buy this in my Jace the Mind Sculptors for $110 bucks each at a GP. Oh, man, that feels good now.
that's glorious to look back on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, you mentioned the Wall Street thing before. So I read a book called One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. And one thing that he tries to emphasize is, you know, missing out on profit, missing out on a gain is not the same thing as a loss. Don't, you know, look at something like, oh, I could have made so much more money on that, but you didn't lose anything, you know? So it's important to keep that perspective in mind. You know, you're not losing if you miss out. You can't be in every position. You can't be in everything before it spikes. It's just not going to happen. So you learn from it, and then you find the next thing.
So I remember in talking about the question of when do you sell, and this comes up a bit now and then with newer users getting into it on Quiet Spec. And I say, you know, what's your threshold for a good day here? Is it a dollar amount on the cards? Is it, for me, it's 100%. If I make 100% on a card, it's out the door the next day.
For sure.
And that means, like, if I buy Whip Flare at 15 cents and I get 100 of them, and then I can buy list them for 30 the next day, like, that's a great day for me, even if they go up to $1 buy list later.
Yeah, sure. Just like with my chokes, I was thrilled, because it was, like, no effort. You know, how long does it take to add 20 chokes to your cart and type in your PayPal, password? Because I buy listed them in person. I didn't have to mail anything. I didn't have to do it, you know, it's just...
And that's where I think Goblin Rabble Master is the biggest sour grapes kind of thing right now, because people are like, I bought it at $2.50 and I sold at $5 and I could have had $25. Or you could have had nothing. And it's like, oh, I should have bought it $9 because then it was going to go up. It went up to $15 the next week. And it's like, you have to ignore that Goblin Rabble Master exists.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Are you the guy who's going to be... If you're the guy looking at the price trajectory and be like, I bought it $2 and I sold it $5 and I hate myself. Like, you have to figure out where along that price trajectory you were happy selling, and the answer can't be at the highest price. Like, because you'll never know the highest price, but you will be able to look at, like, between $5 and $25, where would you have been happy to out those things? And then figure out...
Right.
What level of comfort that was.
Yeah. And the people who rode it the longest and sold at the peak, they also took all that extra risk on, because there was no guarantee it was going to remain a thing. I mean, I suppose if you're a really strong player and you tested it and you were able to determine, yes, this card is going to be huge, then good for you. Leverage those skills. I don't have those skills. I don't know what cards are going to be good. So I'm not going to take on additional risk. If my card doubles, if my Rabble Master's double, I'm out of here, you know?
And there was the Speed vs. Cunning Dual deck, I believe, was... slated to come out around that time when it was spiking, and we didn't know what the spoilers were for it.
True.
And so you were carrying a significant risk if you were looking at $11 and you were hoping it would go up, or you were looking at $18 and you were hoping it'd go up. You know, they've done this before. They did it with Stoneforge Mystic. They attempted to depress the price of Thrag Tusk several times.
Yeah.
You know, you can have your profits evaporate overnight.
Or the card can just not stay good. And in Standard, it's a dynamic format. It's not like Legacy, where a deck could be good for a year or more. I mean, Standard, it changes whenever there are new cards that come into it. Rabble Master could have been Prolic Ancient. You could have bought in a bunch and said, I'm going to hold this for 12 to 20. It's a mythic rare. It's going to go through the roof. You know, I'm stuck holding 4 that I couldn't move fast enough because, you know, I was waiting for them to come in the mail. So, I mean, that's the other side of the coin.
And I think that, you got to know when you want to get out before you get it, I think.
Yeah, I wrote an article about that a long time ago. You should always have an exit strategy. You should never buy into an investment just thinking, well, I'll hold it for a long time, it'll go up. You know, like, people who are buying Thoughtseize now thinking, well, it's a modern Legacy staple, it's gonna go up in the long term. It's like, who knows how long that can take, and you don't know that they're gonna ever reprint it in that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
it's not like you're going out on a date with somebody and then dating. It's like, oh, I just want this to go on as long as it can because it feels nice. It's like, this isn't romance. This is business.
Never fall in love with an investment. That's an important lesson. Even like the same thing in the stock market. You know, it's nice when you look at your paper gains. You know, I bought Rabble Master at $1. Man, these $20 bills are so nice right now. But until you have the cash, you haven't actually banked the profits. And so you shouldn't like an investment more just because it's gone up. You should always look at an investment as, at this given price, would I want to buy more? And if the answer is, well, I don't really think I want to buy more, it's gone up some, then maybe you should think of selling, because you are, indirectly buying those every day you don't sell them.
That's a fascinating point. Yeah, every time you have one, you're indirectly buying it.
Essentially, because that's money that you are saying, I want it in there and not in anything else. And, you know, you can't play the game of hopping from one thing to the next every day, I understand. But I think it's just important to keep in the back of your mind.
So when we're talking about falling in love with cards, are there any cards that you trade for or that you've acquired that you just have kind of a hard time letting go, or that maybe you're being slow to get rid of?
So you're talking about just things that I speculated on.
Or anything.
Well, because I have...
It's come through your hands that's been hard to move, or hard to get rid of.
I have a special binder of cards that I won't get rid of. So, like, you know, I didn't used to do this. In fact, I used to have, you know, collect Legacy. I bought deep into Legacy years ago. I've since sold them all. But I had a binder with all my Legacy cards, and it was in there with everything else. And so people would look through that are trade, and they would get mad at me because I would say, oh, those aren't for trade. And so I learned a very valuable lesson. You know, you annoy people if you have too many cards in your binder that aren't for trade. So now I have a separate binder where I keep my, you know, cards that I'd never want to really get rid of.
It's like a gallery at that point.
Exactly. I have cards, just, I appreciate the artwork of a lot of older cards, so I have a lot of random stuff, and I mean random. I mean, yes, I have, like, I have a Eureka and a Charizard, like some of the really old school favorites, but I also love Headless Horseman. I love the flavor of that card, and, you know, and things, Island of Wok Wok, Singing Tree, just like really old school cards that, you know, have that nostalgic touch.
There's almost a sweet, naive feeling to some of those older cards too.
Absolutely.
That I like. The artwork is simpler. It's a little bit more abstract sometimes. Maybe it's a little, to put it charitably, a little bit more primitive than what we see today.
Did they used to, they touch things up digitally a lot more now, right? As opposed to everything back then was more...
A lot of it is created digitally now, so there are no originals. But I know when I ask people who's your favorite Magic artist, you get, John Maven comes up a lot because he does all the lands.
Yep.
But you get, Kaya Folio, who did Scheherazade. Mm-hmm. You get Drew Tucker. You get Richard Kane Ferguson.
One of my favorites, like, yeah.
These are guys and gals and Rebecca Gay, like people who haven't done this stuff for maybe 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
But it's iconic. It's hard to find iconic artists now in Magic. And I suppose we're getting a little bit off finance, but there's something to be said for something that looks so nice that it's collectible because it's nice.
Absolutely.
Juzan Jin is a card whose value is solely derived from the nostalgia value of that card.
Absolutely, yeah, yep. And, you know, I think about how many new cards I have in that binder where, you know, that are not for trade, and there are a scant few. I actually just tweeted at Therese Nielsen, right? Or is it Therese? How does she?
Your guess is as good as mine.
So, I mean, her, the promo, Hannah, Ship's Navigator, I love the artwork on that. And so I was so eager to pick one up, and I finally found one at a good price. You know, I was very patient because I knew they would spike and then go down. And so that's like one of the few new cards that I think are just beautiful, and I want to keep it in my binder forever, not to trade. You know, there's not much else. That's the sad thing. And I remember looking at new cards and, you know, not even knowing what they did, but just the artwork was always so exciting. And, you know, you'd want to play a card just because it looked cool. Those days are over now. Everything mm-hmm. is so busy.
It is. And I think that there's a forgetfulness that everything gets crammed onto a 2.5-inch square picture.
You can, like, you're never going to see the artwork of Lance again in that in New Magic. If they were to reprint Lance, it would show some warrior holding the weapon and fighting against 20 other bad guys or whatever. It would never just show the weapon. That's what.
Oh yeah, the card Lance.
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's one of the simplest ones that I can think of.
Stasis is one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I mean, there's a big backstory on Stasis. Faye Jones is Richard Garfield's aunt. So people can look it up. She's a fine artist. And it was like a favorite of Richard or something like that. But that's a polarizing card, but at least people can have an opinion about it, you know?
Absolutely.
Burning Tree Emissary, do you have an opinion about the art?
I can't even picture what the new ones look like.
Lightning Greaves, do you have an opinion about the art?
Oh, and then, like, the biggest the culprit, Tarmogoyf. I mean, who likes to look at that?
They had two chances to get that art right. They had two chances and they didn't get it right. So, you know, a little bit, circling back a little bit to finance, do you have big wins that you've made where you feel real proud of a card that you bought and then you rode to its peak?
Yeah, so, I mean, recently, you know, Chalice of the Void is the most recent one, and there was a lot of buzz on Twitter on that one. I noticed that the card was showing up in top lists, both at GP Madrid and then also the Grand Prix in Jersey, so that was a Modern and Legacy tournament. I'm pretty sure that it showed up in both. I know that it showed up in Modern, and I don't remember ever seeing Chalice play in Modern, so that just caught my interest. So I bought a few. In fact, I bought some from Star City with my store credit because their price was still a little low, and that has just blown up, which I'm kind of shocked by. I already sold most of my non-foils. I do have a few foils still. So that's the most recent thing. I did really well on Temple of Malady and Temple of Epiphany, but the other temples have just sucked. It's been really painful, and you know, I think there are a lot of people in this boat with me. I was touting temples. They were supposed to do the same thing that Innistrad Duels did, that Scars of Mirrodin Duels did, that Manlands did, you know, etc. And they aren't behaving. It goes back to what we were talking about before, about how Standard just seems to be crashing and burning, at least from a dollar standpoint. And so, yeah, but those other two temples, the rare ones, I did really well on those. I'm trying to think. It kind of... There's so many little things, because we talked about how I diversify, so I don't buy like 100 or something and then make a huge killing on it. I just like to buy in little increments. I like to buy 8 of this and 12 of that and 4 of those. And so, you know, it's hard for me to keep track of all the price of progress I made some money on not long ago. I think people in the QS forums were on that, and so I decided I'd buy a few on Card Shark and sold those for a small profit.
Is there anything that you really regret buying and that you're still looking at?
Scavenging Ooze.
Tell me more.
It's one of the worst ones. Well, there was a time, and so I'll start by saying, listen carefully, because this is the same, this lesson that I learned on Scavenging Ooze is why I was pushing to sell Thoughtseize to Star City at 1750. Okay, so that being said, Scavenging Ooze, there was a brief week or two where Star City was paying like $10 on the card, and you could find copies on eBay for $8-$9. And so I had a saved eBay search on, and so every time someone listed it, if it was a set for $36, $38, I would buy them. Because everyone felt, well, Scavenging Ooze is played everywhere in Modern and Legacy, it's gonna be worth money. And so it was a great buy. And so I picked up, you know, it's not, again, I don't buy hundreds, but I did pick up like 25, 30 of them. I did buy a lot. And, you know, shortly thereafter, Star City dropped their buy price from 10 to 8 and then to 6 or whatever. And I'm like, okay, well, it'll bounce. And it just never did. And it just kept going down and down and down. And so now I still have a bunch of copies that are worth like $5. And I die inside when a dealer offers me $1 for them or $2. And so, you know, that's, so going back to Thoughtseize, you know, I saw them paying $17.50, but they were selling for less on eBay. You could buy sets for like $70 on eBay, or even less sometimes if you were patient. And that was a red flag to me. And I did buy a few. I bought like a dozen and sold them to Star City for a small profit. Now we're talking very marginal percentage, 5-10%. But, you know, I took the store credit and used those to buy Chalice of the Void. So, you know, I still think there's merit to doing that. And, so when I saw that they were selling for less than what Star City was buying, that to me was a sell signal, not a buy signal. And now Star City's paying, I think, $12.50, and now they're on sale at Star City's site for under $20. So I learned my lesson, even though it was a painful, expensive one to learn.
At least, you know, if you have a stock that goes belly up, it's worthless, but at least Scavenging Ooze has a chance of going up.
I'm not going to get rid of them anytime soon, but, you know, and if someone wanted to trade for it at $5, I'd be happy to, but, like, no one ever really wants
it. And that's a case where I think if you're an active market player and you're on a real limited bankroll that you need to keep moving, like, I think the disciplined trader sells them for as much as he can get today and then puts that money back to work. Because like you were saying, you know, you're buying those cards indirectly every day that you have them.
Yep. Well, but now they're so cheap, they're not such a bad buy after all. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind holding them. They're not worth a whole lot. Like, if I bought them at 100 and now they were 20, I would still be sitting on hundreds of dollars of the cards. But, you know, $50 worth of Scavenging Ooze is not going to make a difference to me, I don't think.
At some point, the card will bounce.
I hope so.
We hope so, yeah. And it's one of those things where if you really need to get the money out, you can sell them too. So a lot of people, when they get involved in finance, they are pursuing different goals, and it's usually something like wanting to play standard for free, wanting to have a complete collection. But I know that you have a little bit more of an unorthodox goal. Why do you engage in Magic Finance at the level you do?
So right now, I am trying to leverage Magic Finance to, you know, the small goal is to have Magic be free. But really, if you just don't play Standard, it's very easy to achieve that because you don't need to continuously get new cards. So now I've stepped up to, I'm trying to save money from Magic Finance to fund my son's college education. So that's the goal, and I think that there's actually like a decent chance that I will put a dent in his tuition. Now, of course, if it goes up in price at the rate it's been going up at, then maybe it won't happen. Maybe it'll be a drop in the bucket. But I have hope that I'll be able to make a dent with it. And, you know, the lucky part for me was I had the cards to build like 6-7 legacy decks. You know, I would read about Reanimator and be like, I want the cards for Reanimator. And then, oh, now there's a Metalworker version where you can play with Goblin Welder or whatever it is. I'm going to buy those. And so I had all these Legacy cards right when it was exploding. And so when I sold out of Legacy, it gave me a really nice bankroll to start with. And so I have a nice chunk. And I will say that while I do have what I consider to be plenty of resources in magic. As I make a little bit more money over time, I take some of the cash and throw it into the stock market in an account for my son, because I don't want to have too many cards in magic, you know, too many dollars in magic cards. So, people, you know, I want people to know that I'm a magic finance guy, and I love it because I think the game is fun, and it's just really exciting. But if you ask me where most of my money is, you know, I have money in stocks and in retirement accounts and all that. So don't use magic for your retirement account, please.
You know, and there are certainly investment grade magic cards at this point. I think mint beta cards, but again,
yes,
you're putting your faith in the fact that there won't be counterfeitable ones that are undetectable. You know, the minute that there's a perfect fake of a $20,000 magic card is the minute that they become worthless.
Yeah.
It's that diversification thing. And
exactly.
I think, like, I don't know that magic will be here in 40 years, but the stock market will be.
Absolutely.
And you get much, much, much better returns in magic than you ever do on the stock market, but on a small frame. So I like the idea of working the small scale, the profits in the thousands over a year, and then taking some of those profits and putting them in the stuff that really compounds over decades.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yep.
So it's wild to think that, you know, like you have a goal when people are trading and
Absolutely.
Doing finance, and it's cool to know that yours is like, I want to help educate my son.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, my parents didn't set up a fund for me. I didn't have any money from them for college, or at least nothing saved up. And so that's something that I want to try to do for my son. And to be fair, it's also a good excuse for the wife as to why I spend so much time on all this. And she knows that, you know, that there's some money to it, and then again, I tell her when I'm going to go to this magic tournament on Saturday. I ask her, would you prefer I went to a strip club or a bar with some friends, or would you prefer I go hang out with, you know, 500 smelly guys or whatever? You know, no offense. On average, you know, 500 guys, you know, and then 10 girls or whatever.
Yeah, but you're using your mind. You're meeting new people. You're talking about shared interests.
Oh yeah,
stuff.
From that perspective, magic keeps the mind sharp.
Yeah, absolutely.
Forget it. I think you have to be actually fairly intelligent to play magic. I think there's a lot of complex interactions. I mean, you can probably get the basics, but I think, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, I think that there's some acknowledgement that, you know, it takes some smarts to get it.
I would like to think that everybody listening to this podcast is smart. Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, even the vocabulary helps out. It's just the way that you think. It's the way that you read people, you figure out scenarios. Magic is a wonderful thing. And I know that people, especially in magic finance, you know, I talk to some people who it's like, I don't play magic anymore. I trade and play around with cards, and I like having them. The cards provide a lot of income. I don't sit down and play magic, but it's like, I still read articles. I still look at all the new sets. I like to see how the tournament results are. So there's a whole lot of participation in that ecosystem.
Absolutely.
That goes beyond just the cards.
That's kind of how I live it right now. I don't have time to go to large events. I should rephrase and say, I have family obligations, and I prefer to prioritize time with family over going to magic events. And so people ask me, are you going to GPXYZ? And my response is always the same. You know, unless I can drive there in like an hour or two, probably won't be going. It's just the state of life that I'm in right now, the stage. And one way that I can still stay involved with the game without exerting a whole lot of time is doing the finance mm-hmm. stuff. Because it doesn't take long to read an article, buy a few cards off of it, and then list them on eBay later. Mm-hmm. It's no big deal.
Yeah, and you know, it's like if you aren't actively golfing, you're not an active golfer. You're not a golfer. Like if you watch golf on TV, that doesn't make you a golfer. Whereas if you still read articles and do that kind of stuff, it's still part and parcel of the magic community.
Yeah, and you can still engage with the community and have a say and, you know, really have a good dialogue.
Absolutely. Well, Sig, we are going to wrap up now. It's been wonderful having you on the show. Sig, you are local to Cincinnati. I am broadcasting from Cincinnati right now, so we will have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. I wish I could do this more often.
So if people want to find you on Twitter, how will they find you?
I'm at SigFig8, so it's SIGFIG, then the numeral 8.
Great, and I have to say, follow Sig there. You can follow us. It's QuietSpec on Twitter, and we would love to get questions and responses from you guys. And definitely hop on Twitter if you like this episode And thanks, Sig, for taking part. So, thank you. You have been listening to the Insider Stories podcast. It is brought to you by Quiet Speculation. I am your host, Doug Lynn. You can go to quietspeculation.com or mtgcast.com, and you can find all of our show archives there, and you can participate and give us feedback. And until next time, I'm Doug Lynn. Thanks for listening.